The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library. My name's Evelyn Minnick. I'm a retired librarian who is just so thrilled to be able to read anything she wants to read. Retirement is just delicious. And I am so excited that Elizabeth Stroud is here this evening. I may be her biggest fan. Olive Kitteridge is one of my five favorite women in literature. She's right up there with Becky Sharp, Dorothea Brooke, and Elizabeth Bennett. Elizabeth Stroud was born in Portland, Maine, and raised in small towns in Maine and New Hampshire. She was always a writer and a keen observer of life, but took diversions into law, gerontology, and teaching before she published her first novel, Amy and Isabel, at the age of 43. Amy and Isabel was shortlisted for the Orange Prize and nominated for the Penn Faulkner Award. It was also adapted into a television movie produced by Oprah Winfrey and starring Elizabeth Shue. In 2009, Ms. Stroud published Olive Kitteridge, a series of connected stories about a woman on the coast of Maine. Olive won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and was adapted into an HBO miniseries, winning 8 Emmy Awards and starring Frances McDormand. Her latest novel, My Name is Lucy Barton, is a small book that packs a wallop. Lucy, a writer, finds herself hospitalized for 9 weeks with an unexplained illness. 3 weeks into her stay, she wakes to find her mother at the foot of her bed, a mother she has not seen in years. The next 5 days are full of conversation about her rural hometown in Illinois, flashbacks to poverty and emotional deprivation. So much is said, but more is unsaid, as they circle around things they can't broach directly. As Claire Massoud says in the New York Times Book Review, Stroud articulates for her readers the Gordian knot of family, binding together fear and misery, solace and love. Interviewing Ms. Stroud this evening will be Laura Kovacs, the Associate Director of Author Events here at the library. Please join me in welcoming Elizabeth Stroud and Laura Kovacs.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's an honor to have you here. It's an honor to add you to our ranks here at the library.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Let's get right to it.
Okay.
So your main character in this book is a writer.
Right.
What's that like for you?
That was weird. Let's just get right to it. As you said, that was weird. I never thought of myself as someone who would write about a writer because... So that came along. I don't write from beginning to end, and so I can't say it was in the middle of anything, but it was in the middle of making the mess that I make in order to get the book to be a book that I realized Lucy would be a writer, and it was pretty daunting. That was about the biggest decision I made. And I made it because when she stays after school to stay warm as a young person, and she realizes that books have brought her things, and she feels less alone. And I thought, oh, okay, maybe she'll be a writer. And I, tried not to, but I finally did.
That book that meant so much to her as a child, she really connects with a character by the name of Tilly. And to me, that that section was all about the transformative power of literature.
Right.
And the hope that she found for reinvention through books.
Right.
And I wonder what literature has meant to you in your life in that way.
Right. And that was the part, that Tilly thing, that made me realize that she would probably have to be a writer. So, you know, I have always read. I think my mother was just talking to me a few days ago, and she said, you know, you read very, very early, and I don't remember, but apparently I did. But I don't remember reading children's books. I think my father read me Beatrix Potter, but I don't remember reading children's books. I do remember reading, you know, Updike when I was very young. And, I remember it was interesting. You know, I didn't quite get it, but I got the sense that there was a whole world out there. Oh, boy. And I remember reading To Kill a Mockingbird when I was really young, because that had just come out, and I heard my mother telling my father about it, so I read that. You know, so I read a lot, and Hemingway's entire works were on our shelf. My grandfather had apparently bought them from some salesman who came around, and so I went right through those, you know, at a young age, younger than most people probably would have read Hemingway for the first time. So I just loved it all.
In writing as a form of communication, you're writing for a reader maybe in mind, or maybe somebody who just needs your work. What is it like when you're on tour? What are these first few weeks like for you?
Well, it's a little daunting, because I spend so much time alone. I spend a lot of time alone, and here I am, and here you are, and it's very nice. But, you know... what were you asking? I'm sorry.
I think the audience looks very nice. Don't be scared.
Right.
A book tour. What's it like for you? What is it like to actually meet the readers who are in your mind as you're writing?
I do really like meeting my readers. I meet them about every 7 years, I think. But I really, really like meeting readers, and I love the different remarks and comments that they'll make in passing. It's wonderful, because I write for readers. I don't write for myself. I write for you people. If you want the book, that's the reader I'm writing for. So,
yeah. Lucy at one point in the novel travels basically to a writing workshop and meets a mentor by the name of Sarah Payne. And the book she's workshopping is this one, mm-hmm. We think. And I'm wondering, if Sarah Payne were to read this book, she's always so concerned about the truth and getting to the the most emotional, truthful spot she can find.
Right.
I'm wondering if Sarah would read this book and say, you've got it, you're there, this is the one story, or would she say, Lucy, you have to keep going?
That's a really good question. I think she would say, you got it, Lucy.
This is her one story.
I think that's what she'd say. Yeah. Right down to the title, which is, you know, my name is Lucy Barton, a statement, an assertion, because Sarah Payne could never...
She couldn't say her
own
name.
She couldn't say her own name.
Yeah.
So...
I've heard that you generally don't read your reviews, so I'll tell you. Your debut novel, Amy and Isabel, the New York Times reviewer mentioned the ruthless intimacy in your writing.
Oh, interesting.
And towards the end of this... surprise. Towards the end of this book, Lucy is told by a fellow artist, her friend Jeremy, you have to be ruthless in order to be a writer. And as far as writerly advice goes, would that be your take?
You know, I don't think ruthless is a word that I would use myself. It's not my word particularly. It was Jeremy's word in the book, but I don't think I could tell somebody to be ruthless. I just don't think that's the word I would use. But I understand what Jeremy meant. You see. I don't know what word I would use. I think I would say you just have to go for it. If you're going to do this, you just have to do it, which is not quite the same.
It's nicer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little more qualified, you know.
Yeah.
But so I can't. You know, I just can't. I can't say that I would say ruthless, but I understand.
I'd actually love if you would read just a brief section. It's just mm-hmm. a long paragraph in here.
Paragraph? Until there? Okay.
Thank you.
I think of Jeremy telling me I had to be ruthless to be a writer, and I think I did not go to visit my brother and sister and my parents because I was always working on a story and there was never enough time, but I didn't want to go either. There never was enough time, and then later I knew if I stayed in my marriage, I would not write another book, not the kind I wanted to, and there is that as well. But really, the ruthlessness, I think, comes in grabbing onto myself and saying, this is me, and I will not go where I can't bear to go, to Amgash, Illinois, and I will not stay in a marriage when I don't want to, and I will grab myself and hurl onward through life, blind as a bat, but on I go. This is the ruthlessness, I think. My mother told me in the hospital that day that I was not like my brother and sister. Look at your life right now, she said. You just went ahead and did it. Perhaps she meant that I was already ruthless. Perhaps she meant that, but I don't know what my mother meant.
Thank you very much. To me, that is beautiful writing. I'm sure it meant a great deal to the writers in the audience. I wonder if the muscularity of a sentence is connected to the heft of a story.
Oh, I think a sentence is everything. I just think the sound of a sentence, the muscularity of the sentence or the leanness of the sentence, whatever. You know, the sentence is, and the sound of the sentence is what will convey the story to you. So I just am a huge believer in the sentence and the sound of the sentence. That's what it is for me, always.
There are a lot of aspects of Lucy's childhood, and particularly her mother's childhood, that kind of go unsaid.
And right.
Families go through whole lifetimes without mentioning difficult aspects. Things happen, we move on, we don't talk about it. In this social media saturated time of oversharing, so much appears to be said, but yet maybe I would say people are not telling their deepest, darkest secrets. Does that kind of a sensibility, do you think, of don't air your dirty laundry exist anymore?
That's a really interesting thing that you just said, actually, if I understand it right. If I don't, then it wasn't. No, I really,
go with that.
No. I think that, like when you said, you know, you sharing, you know, the dirty laundry, and yet you said that you don't think people really are saying
the
darkest.
People are saying so many things about themselves.
They're saying so many things, but is it really getting at what's actually happened? Is that what you're saying? Or
it is, yeah. And I guess the bigger question really is, in terms of the aesthetic that we're fostering, are we fostering more of a short, like, you know, a fondness for a short form? We're demanding people to sit and concentrate and read.
You know, the truth is, I don't know. I just don't know. I think we're in the middle of a revolution. Well, we're clearly in the middle of a revolution. The whole social thing. We're just plunk in the middle of it. We can't quite tell at this point what is going to be happening ultimately with that. So I guess I just don't know. But there is an awful lot of chatter about almost anything, and yet I don't feel that it really gets to the seriousness or the depth of what it may be representing.
Right, the emotional truth.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And hopefully it's literature like yours that endures. And again, you didn't read this review, so I will just read this. I'd like you to address, as a fellow writer, Claire Massoud's New York Times review in the last paragraph. And I know you didn't see it. It's glowing. So,
okay.
Here's the lessons. Whether Strout once had a literary guide like Sarah Payne, an imperfect guide, flawed as are all these beautifully two human characters, or whether she herself has been one, her fiction certainly enacts the fierce clarity of vision Payne demands. There is not a scintilla of sentimentality in this exquisite novel. Can you address that? the literary guide. Have you ever been a mentor? Did you have any?
You know, let me mention the literary mentors that I feel that I had. I always stayed away from taking a writing course in college. They were offered, and I never ever took one. I just didn't want to. I just instinctively thought, I don't want to do that. But I had a professor, and he was the chairman of the English department, and he knew that I wanted to be a writer. And the very first paper I turned in for him, I don't know, it was on some poet or something, and he said, you know, he called me in his office, and he said, you know, I could teach you to write an analytical paper, but I'm not going to. I don't think it would be good for you. And so every time you have a paper due, you give me a short story. And, yeah, it was an amazing thing. And I, you know, I took 3 or 4 classes from this guy. and I don't think anybody ever knew. I really don't. I don't think anybody ever knew that I was just giving him a short story instead of a paper. And he would comment on them sort of briefly. He'd say, well, I like the other one better or whatever. But it was a very important relationship for me, and I was young, and so I don't think I quite understood how important it was at the time, but I sure do now. And that was a wonderful thing. Have I been a mentor? You know, there are a couple of students that I still work with a little bit, and I don't know if they would think that I was a mentor. Or not. I don't know. We could ask them. but yeah, I don't know.
Thanks. I'd like for you to talk about using memory as a plot device. There's a lot in this book that has to do with memory and just the nature of the recollection.
Right. Well, plot is something that I never, I don't ever think about plot. I actually never worry about plot. And I always assume it will take care of itself, and it always does. And a lot of writers I know worry about plot. I talk to them, and they tell me, I'm trying to get this to do this or this or this. And, you know, I don't say anything because... But I think to myself, well, you know, stop worrying about it because it will... The way I write, and I'll get to the memory thing, but the way I write is when I sit down to do a sketch or a little draft of something, I will write from whatever the most urgent thing is that I'm feeling at that moment, and I'll transpose it onto some character or just do something, because then it will have some sort of life to it, and it won't be wooden. And then if I just do that enough and move these papers around enough for years and years, it just shows itself. It comes together in a way. And that certainly happened with Lucy. I would, you know, just write different things. I don't write from beginning to end. And I would just write different things that came to me on a particular day. And then I'd set it aside. And then eventually I'd think, oh, where's that? You know, piece of paper. And most of the time I would find it. You know. So memory for Lucy is also how I decided, you know, because it's first person. And I've never written a book in first person before. And that was also daunting for me. But I decided, one of the reasons that I let myself go with that, not only the tone of the sentences that I began to hear her voice, but I realized that there was a retrospective aspect, that this was a woman looking back. And so that helped me with the fear that I would have of the reader being stuck in someone's head. You know, first person can be cloying sometimes. And I didn't want that to happen. So I had that sense of her looking back and therefore the memories would naturally be there.
And it gives her a little bit of leeway, too.
Yeah.
In that memory is its own kind of fiction.
Exactly. Exactly. And she knows that and acknowledges it, I think, doesn't she?
She does, yeah.
Right.
As a matter of fact, just an example, you know, she seems to often kind of almost question herself in the last sentence of a paragraph, just for an example. I have no memory of my mother ever kissing me. She may have kissed me. I may be wrong. And that's where you end. And it just kind of gives her a little bit of leeway.
Right, exactly. And you know what else? It's funny because sometimes people have said, well, is she a reliable narrator? But that's my way of making her reliable, because I think that's the most truthful way she can present that. You know, she honestly doesn't know if her mother kissed her. She doesn't think she did, but she doesn't know. And so I'm trying to make her reliable. I'm just letting you know she's a reliable narrator.
She does. She rings true. She's believable. Yeah. I wonder if you would read another section. This is very brief. So Lucy has grown up in a small town of Amgash, Illinois, and she has stayed late in school every day and basically educating herself and has set out for New York. And this section I'd like you to read, just that one paragraph I've marked, is right as she moves to New York.
Near the college, I got a job, and I bought clothes in a thrift shop. It was the mid-70s, and clothes like that were acceptable, even if you were not poor. To my knowledge, no one spoke of how I dressed. But once, before I met my husband, I fell very much in love with a professor, and we had a brief affair. He was an artist, and I liked his work, though I understood that I did not understand it. But it was him I loved, his harshness, his intelligence, his awareness that certain things had to be foregone if he was to have the life he could have. Like children, they were foregone. But I record this now for one purpose alone. He was the only person I remember from my youth as mentioning my clothes, and he mentioned them by comparing me to a woman professor in his department who dressed expensively and was physically large, as I was not. He said, "You have more substance, but Irene has more style." I said, "But style is substance." I didn't know yet that such a thing was true.
Thank you. I'm wondering if you would talk about style and substance in your writing.
Right. Well, style is substance. It just is, actually. And so for example, you know, the style of the Burgess Boys is a very different style from Lucy Barton. The style of Olive Kittredge is a very different style from the Burgess Boys. And it has to be that way because that's what the books are. Like, the Burgess Boys is the Burgess Boys because of how it's written. It's not the Burgess Boys because it's about the Burgess Boys. It's because of how it's written. And it's written in a more linear form. It's got thicker sentences, thicker stuff. There's lots of stuff going on, and that's because that's the story. Olive is written as a series of stories because that's how that story is conveyed. It wouldn't be Olive if it was written the way the Burgess Boys, if it was written in a linear narrative. And Lucy Barton has her own style. So, you know, I remember when I figured that out. I was very young. I was like 20-something. And I was working, it sounds stupid to explain it, but I was working as a secretary. I had so many jobs in my life. But when I had a job as a secretary, and they didn't really have anything for me to do. And it was great because I had a typewriter. And so I would, you know, type stories. And I realized in that office that it wasn't the story, it was how it was told.
That's what's so striking to me about this book in particular. There's the emotional truth, there's the story itself, but then there's the craftsmanship of the work. This is different in not yeah. only in that it's first yeah. person, but your sentences here are tight. Yeah. Occasionally, yeah. Lucy repeats herself like for emphasis. I mean,
yeah,
it's striking. Thank you for addressing that.
Yeah, it's a different kind of work.
There are things about Lucy's mother that you never revealed, specifically her name, but also there's more than that. Her aspects of her childhood, you know. No spoilers here, but so they're, you know, the root of her fear or her catnapping. Mm-hmm. As you're writing her as a character, are those details that you fill in? Do you know those facts about her?
No, I don't, actually. And that's an interesting question. No, I don't know those facts about her. I don't. I'm not somebody who writes backstories for my characters the way some people do. I sort of know what I feel like I need to know about them. And I really, you know, since this was Lucy's story, I needed to share her sense of the mother as an enigma. And if I knew more than Lucy, then that would get in the way. And so I you know, stayed back and thought, I don't know why. I don't know what the mother's story is.
So interesting. Class is a theme that shows up often in your fiction. Certainly, it's central to this book. Tell us a bit about why it's a theme of interest to you.
Well, thank you for mentioning that, first of all, because I do think I write about class, and I think I've written about class ever since Amy and Isabel. That certainly has, you know, class issues right there, but it doesn't get talked about much. But I'm very interested in class. And I think we don't talk about it that much in this country because we don't quite know what it is we're talking about. I don't know. I don't know why we don't talk about it. But, you know, there's some discomfort and there's some... But anyway, with Lucy, I thought, okay, I'm going to make this a distilled story of class. This is a girl who comes from real rural poverty. The kind that, you know, every town has or probably now has more. But there would always be a family that was so poor that they could not be a part of the community. And it's just so sad. It's just terrible. But so I thought I'm going to bring her from that kind of background and she's going to cross class lines and end up at the end of the book, arguably an upper middle class woman living in New York City. And what is that like for her? That was interesting to me.
Because that isolation, you know, due to her class, follows her entire life.
Yeah,
because even
absolutely.
When she gets to New York, she's an outsider in that she came from different circumstances.
Right, exactly. And I was just remembering the other night, I was remembering there was a boy in our third grade class who was that child. He was so poor, he had no friends, and he sat in front of me, and the teacher said to him one day, you have dirt behind your ears. Nobody is too poor to buy a bar of soap. And he turned bright red, and I just remember. It's a horrible, horrible thing. So in a way, this book is a little, you know, sort of maybe a little homage toward that person or... That sadness, terrible.
Amy and Isabel also focus on a mother-daughter relationship.
Yeah.
What drew you to write another?
Oh, well, I mean, I think, you know, mother-daughters, they're awfully interesting to me, personally. they're different mothers, and they're different daughters that I write about, but, you know, I mean, a mother is just so... It's just such a basic, fundamental, primal relationship. It's, you know, for a lot of us anyway. It's how we see the world the first time in many ways. And so I think for a novelist, or for this novelist, it's been Christopher Mill? I'm using conventional text. I shouldn't do that. It's my thing.
You've mentioned before there's something of yourself in all of your characters, and certainly someone reading this book is just so quick to assume that Lucy is you. Are there? I think so. I think the writer talking about a writer, you want to think it's a window into your life. Is it autobiographical at all, or in what ways has Lucy's experience as a writer different from yours?
Well, Lucy, you know, she came from my imagination, and it's true that every character I write, whether it's a man or a woman or a child or whatever, there's always the kernel of myself somewhere in there because I'm the only person I have to work with. I mean, you know, in a sense, like I only know myself, if I know that much. But Lucy, as a writer, she didn't have the breaks I had. I mean, my mother made me a writer. I mean, by the time I was 4 years old, my mother was giving me notebooks and she was saying, now you write down what you did today, you write down what you saw today. And I go, okay. And I wrote them all down and I thought in terms of sentences. And she told me, you know, when I was probably 15, well, you're an artist. I was like, okay. So, you know, I had, you know, some advantages that Lucy didn't have.
For Lucy, what are the costs of standing out in a kind of small society? And does she continue to stand out? And just in the simple fact of she left, and now she's a cause for gossip in that way.
Which society are you talking about? Amgash?
She's isolated there, and she stands out a bit there.
Right.
And then I'm wondering, they probably still talk about her after she leaves, and then an effect on her mother and her father
of
and
course.
Her siblings.
Of course. Oh, yes, I understand. Yes, that's interesting. They must still talk about her. Of course they do. Oh, yes, of course they do. Are you kidding?
Right.
You know, she got away. She got away. Who did she think she was? Not only was she despicable because she was so poor, but then she got uppity. So, you know, yeah, of course. And that's not going to be easy for the family to have to hear. Yeah.
And there's poverty and there's also abuse. And you focus really on Lucy's reaction, but we do know what came of her brother and we do know what came of her sister as well. Yeah, and you have to wonder what effect would that have on them? You don't have to answer that because it's not in the book, but
right. But you do. You're right. You do have to wonder.
Yeah. This book shifts dates, times. You know, it's always in her perspective. But where did you start with writing it?
You know, I wrote. A few of the hospital scenes with the mother visiting Lucy in the hospital, which is basically the backbone of the book. I mean, that's where it flows from that. If I recall correctly, those were the first couple of scenes that I wrote, and they just floated around. I was working on many different things at the time, and I wasn't especially interested in them, to tell the truth. And it was quite a while that they just sort of went around my desk, and then I finally looked and thought, And I do think it was the tone. My ear picked up something that probably didn't want to deal with at first because I didn't want to do the first person. I even tried to make it third person. There's no way that could happen. But, you know, I think the original scenes were a couple of those scenes with the mother and the daughter visiting. The mother visiting.
What's your editing process like when you're collecting all these bits of paper?
It's very messy. I'm very, very messy. And I just like to make a mess. I really do. I always have. So I write by hand, and I'll, you know, toss it around, and I'll write another thing by hand. So there's all sorts of things running around the desk, and then, or the table, basically. And then bit by bit, you know, eventually I'll put them in the, you know, I'll type something in the computer when I can't read it anymore, and then I'll just mess it up again because it makes me happy to have mess. And then there does come a point, not so much of panic, but just of real chaos, which is almost uncomfortable for even me with my high regard for messiness, where I realize, oh, wow, what is this all about? And then that will pass, and I will begin to arrange, and I'll begin to see. But I rewrite all the time. Like, I rewrite as soon as I write the scene, I'll rewrite it, and then I'll rewrite it. So I guess I didn't mention that when I was saying, it's like I just rewrite it immediately, and then I'll rewrite it again. And then I rewrite it as it gets unfolded, and then I'll rewrite it again. You know, I just am always rewriting. And especially with Lucy, I just needed to pare it down and get the essence of her.
Even your characters, are they subject to that kind of constant alteration?
No, my characters, I pretty much know my characters. Some of them are a little harder, like Isabel Goodrow. She was a little bit difficult to get to know, but I was newer. I mean, I was 43. I pretty much know my characters, so they're not going to change that much, but the sentences that are going to be conveying them to you will be changing.
I have time for one more question, so I'll make it an easy one. Have we heard the last from Olive Kittredge?
Oh. I don't know. I don't know. I really honestly don't know.
People in this room are clinging to that hope right now.
Aw. That's so nice. I don't know. I honestly don't know.
Thank you, and I thank you so very much.
No, thank you.
So I think most of the audience knows how this works. Please raise your hand and ask a question, and we will get a microphone to you right away. Miriam, let's start right here in the third row, white sweater and a scarf.
Thank you so much. We're fascinated by your process, and I couldn't help but wondering, when you wrote Olive Kittredge, where did you start? What was your first vision, and how did that grow?
Exactly. And I actually do remember this. My first vision of Olive Kittredge was standing by the picnic table at her son's wedding. And I just saw her. And I heard the inside of her head say, "It's high time everybody goes home." And I wrote that down as fast as I could, you know, those three sentences. And that's when I saw Olive. And I knew, it was wonderful. I don't know how I knew, but I knew that I was going to write stories of Olive. And I thought, I'm going to write a bunch of stories about Olive, and they're going to be called the Olive Stories. But they didn't want stories in the title, so. But I did do that, you know, I mean, I did write the stories. Because I knew immediately that they were going to be stories. I don't know why. So that's how Olive showed up, by the picnic table. Yeah.
Since the sound of sentences is so important,
yeah,
I'm wondering how much of your process happens out loud as you're working.
You know, that's a good question. I used to read aloud to myself a lot, and then I began to realize that I was good at fooling myself. Like, I realized, oh, I can make this sound good. And so it's not as helpful, you know. So I don't read aloud as much as I did, because I can fool myself. So I have to just look at it and hear it in my head.
Hello. I haven't read this novel yet, although I have it in my bag. But I was interested in what you said about class, because I find in your novels that your characters often find comfort and grace from a character who is not of their class and maybe a character that they least expect would happen. And I think that's such... Your novels have so much heart for that reason, and I enjoy that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That's interesting. Thanks.
You read this section so beautifully. I heard her voice, and I just checked on my phone to see if there was an audible version of the book. And I see that there is, but you're not the reader.
Oh, right.
Why wouldn't you be the reader?
Why wouldn't that? I don't know. How did that happen? Seriously. That's so interesting, because when did that happen? I don't even remember. I mean, I don't... Usually they say, oh, well, here's somebody who's... Whatever. But I don't remember them ever discussing that with me. Yeah. Oh. Okay, well. Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. Thank you.
I'm not sure exactly how to phrase this, but how do you know when to stop bothering your own sentences? Partly saying that because you can read it in a way that convinces you. Maybe then 2 weeks later you read it and you say, I was deluding myself. Then you realize you are savaging it and you should stop, and et cetera.
Yeah, you're exactly right. It's, experience has helped because of, I just couldn't figure it out. I just kept thinking, is it right? Is it right? Is it not right? Is it right? And I'm better now. I have a better sense of being able to hear it. I think it's just partly experience. But it's not immediate. It's just not immediate. And that's really what I spend most of my time doing, frankly. As I rewrite, I'm really rewriting for the sound. Where is that sound? Where is that sound? Where is it? Where is it? And then once I get it, and I know that I have it, or I feel like I have it, then I can, it's sort of like, being on a bicycle and saying, okay, now I can continue. I don't know if I answered that well because, just experience, I think.
Hi, I want to say I enjoy all your work. It's great.
Thank you.
But I was asked to ask you a question. My friend was raised in Litchfield, New Hampshire with you. She couldn't be here tonight. And she wondered if her Aunt Ruthie Goff had any influence on Olive Kitteridge. Her aunt is very much like Olive.
She may very well have.
her name is Marion Colby.
I don't remember Mary Colby, but it doesn't mean that, I didn't bump into her at some point. There's a number of Olive Kitteridge types in New England to bump into, but no, I don't think I have.
We've talked a lot about mothers and daughters tonight, and I think what I love so much about your books is that it feels like a mother's hug because you're so honest and so brave. So I just wanted to know, do you ever feel afraid of your own bravery while you're writing?
Yes, I do.
And how do you get through that?
Well, that's the biggest, it's a really, really good question. It's the biggest thing for a writer to deal with, I think. And I've seen it with students so many times, because you have to just do it, or you're not going to, you might be able to write a really good story, but you're not going to write a great story if you can't be that brave and say what you know in your heart you need to say. And it was one of the reasons that it was frustrating for me to teach. Because I would see students and they would have, real abilities and stuff, and yet I mean, just for an example, I remember a student saying, oh, well, I couldn't write that. My boyfriend would, you know, hate me. And I would think, well, okay. I mean, I get it, so go be with your boyfriend. I mean, I wouldn't say that, but, you know, I mean, it's like you can't have both.
Be ruthless.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. I mean, you have a different boyfriend. But you couldn't have that boyfriend. You see what I'm saying? But she wanted that boyfriend. So what could you do, you know? But yes, you're exactly right. It does scare me. And
well,
it
thank you for being so brave.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks.
I so admire you, first of all. I loved Olive for so many reasons. I assume a lot of people here are avid readers, and reading is really up there in terms of the joy of life.
Yeah.
And I know that you read as a child, and I can tell that writing for you is joyful.
Yeah.
Is it difficult to read other novelists? Have you lost the... The joy of reading.
No, you know, I read all the time. I have read all the time ever since I could read, which, according to my mother, was very young, as I just told you. But if I didn't read, I mean, like some writers will say, well, I can't read something because I'm working on my own voice here. If I would never read because it takes me so long to write something. So, you know, I have always been reading as I write. But I'm careful about what I read in the sense that I read what I think is good. I can't read stuff that I don't think is... I don't read things that I think are bad sentences. It's just not good for me. It's just like eating bad food, which I'll do, but I won't, you know, but I won't... I can't consume bad sentences, so... Well, I know, you know, because I know what a good sentence is, especially if I haven't written it. Then it's like, oh, this is a gorgeous sentence, you know. So I read the classics, and I've read them again and again and again. And Alice Munro, I've read, you know, all of her stuff, and William Trevor, you know, and Updike and Roth, and you know, just the people who put it out there and write gorgeously render things. So
I was wondering, in your 20s and 30s, when you weren't a full-time writer did you imagine that what you were doing was supporting your eventual writing career, or did you imagine you were having other careers and writing was something different?
No, I always thought that I was working toward my career, that I was, this was my career, and that nobody knew it yet. And that went on for a long time, much longer than became comfortable, but there was no choice. I just kept doing it. Yes, in my 20s and 30s, you know, I was raising my daughter and I was teaching, and I had a very strict schedule cut out for myself of when I would be writing. But I was always working toward where I am now. And I knew that I wasn't good enough. I knew back in my 20s and my 30s when I was getting rejected by the New Yorker, I knew in my heart that even though, you know, this one person started to write me actual personal letters and said, oh, this is better than, you know, 85% of what we get, I still understood it wasn't actually yet good enough. I understood it in my heart. And so I just kept cutting my teeth. Yeah.
I have read everything that you've published, and there are characters, particularly Olive and Tyler, that I love so much. I think of them as like old friends.
Yeah.
So if I pass them on my bookcase, I stop and I go, I wonder what they're doing now.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's so nice.
I feel a little crazy when I do that, but I wonder what she's doing right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's crazy. But I wonder if you ever have a feeling of sort of like you miss them or...
Yeah, I do. And it, I'm so happy to hear you say Tyler because I really...
He's lovely.
I love Tyler.
I do, too.
And nobody talks about him that much, and so thank you. I'm so happy.
He's wonderful.
I'm so happy you like Tyler. I love Tyler.
I do, too.
I'm so glad.
He's beautiful.
I'm so glad.
Yeah.
And I do think about... I do think about him. I do, and I do miss him. I miss him more than I miss Olive because she's still Olive. She's so, you know, she's still sort of rattling around there. You know, so I have a softness in my heart for.
He needs our love.
He
yeah,
does.
I know. Yeah.
He does.
I know. I know.
He does. You're exactly right. And I do. So I do miss. I do miss Tyler,
That's
and I do
nice.
Think about him. And I miss. I miss Isabel, a little bit. You
I
know,
do
and
too.
And you know, I assume Amy's okay, but. You know, but I, yeah, yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Lucy Barton appeared on my Kindle this morning, and I've read about half of it, which has been so wonderful. And what I've noticed in Lucy Barton and Burgess Boys and Olive is that someone travels from the small town to the big city.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really interested in your travels.
Yeah.
And the Yes.
Yeah, yeah. I did come from small towns, and I ended up in a big city. That's absolutely true. A couple of small towns in New Hampshire and in Maine, and then and I did end up in New York City 32 years ago. 32 years ago. And so that, you know, but it takes me a long time to, like, I recognized, quite a while ago, I recognized I think I have about a 15-year lag period before I can write about, you know, like a place or a time period or something. Maybe it's shorter now that I'm older, but when I first moved to New York, I couldn't write about New York. It just was not in me. It wasn't in my cells. And I would write about Maine because that was my DNA, and it just... You know, I think there was a level of homesickness and whatever. But now I've lived in New York for so long that I feel that, you know, it is in me, and so I can write about it. But the whole business of small town versus city is a very... There's many, many stories that can be told about that alone. And obviously have been all throughout history. You know, there's a... Well, we have a place in Maine. we bought a little place in Maine a few years ago. So so now it's like, okay, now I have two places that I can, you know, feel like I don't quite fit. So, you know, that's good. That's good.
Miriam, there's a question right here in the first row. Yeah.
Hi. I'm just thinking about your... How long you plugged away at writing, and even when you knew you weren't quite
yeah.
good enough. And I'm thinking about this poem by Yeats called "The Choice," where you have there's
yeah.
a choice between the life and the art.
Yeah.
What did you? Were there things that you really had to give up and regretted giving up, or were the hardest to give up, or were you able in the long run to have it all?
You know, I think that there are things that I gave up, but I didn't feel like I was giving them up, if you see what I'm saying, because it was just what I had to do. It was just my life. But I just was really, you know, very, very concerned with my work a lot. And It was who I was, and so in that sense, I don't feel like I gave stuff up because I couldn't have done otherwise. You know, I didn't. I mean, I never had dinner parties the way other people did, because it took time. You know, it takes a lot of time. Wow. I mean, I had a couple, just enough to know that I didn't wasn't wasn't going to be my thing. You know, so I didn't, so there, so, you know, I mean, I'm actually trying to be serious because that's like parts of life that I just didn't have, but it's because it really wasn't me as much as because, you know, I was working.
You haven't said anything, and I'm not surprised that you haven't,
because nobody's asking the question, but did you have any particular reaction to the film of Olive Kitteridge? Because I have read, I mean, I loved both the book and the film, but I was very impressed by the fact that I've read that Frances McDormand was very much behind that film, and that she wanted to be Olive. And it's not a choice that you would think a lot of actresses would have made.
Exactly.
So any comment that you
want to make? No, I agree. I thought, well, first of all, I thought they did a wonderful job. I just thought it was a wonderful job, and I was so glad when I saw it. I felt like, first of all, I was just so happy, and then I also had a great sense of relief because I realized, oh my God, it could have been awful. And it hadn't really occurred to me, but it was not. It was wonderful. And yes, Frances was behind it. She made that decision. She pushed for it, and she was the motivating force behind that. And good for her. I mean, wow. She did it, and she did a great, great job. Richard Jenkins was just wonderful. So, yeah, so I loved it. I was very happy with it.
In that mess on your desk.
Yeah, the mess on my desk, yeah.
What do we have to look forward to?
Oh, well, I would love to tell you. I really would love to tell you. But I can't, because it's you know why? Because there's a pressure that has to build up. And if I talk about it, and you can tell how chatty I am, it'd be very easy for me to sit here and tell you, oh. But it leaks it. It just takes it out, and I've learned that, so I can't talk about it. Huh? Yeah. Let the mess rest. Exactly. Yes. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.